Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's guests are two gentlemen behind the Grassroots Co-op, which is the highest possible standard for animal tracking and welfare for being part of our ecosystem and part of our food. They're both at home in Arkansas for today's episode. And we're going to talk about what's really going on in slaughterhouses, not from a shaming perspective, but from a, hey, you can't buy what you think is meat right now, and why that's going on, from people who have actually worked on disrupting that by telling you what's happening in your food. First guest here, Cody Hopkins, is a physicist turned farmer, and he's the CEO of Grassroots Farmers Co-op. Spent 12 years doing vertically integrated sustainable livestock farming. And just if you're a longtime listener, you hear me mention my farm. Guys, I have a dozen pigs, a dozen sheep. I am nowhere near Cody's level at all on this, or Andy's level, who's the CEO of Cypress Valley Meat Company in Arkansas. Who's a powerhouse in the meat industry, at least the company is, and I guess you could say Andy is as well. I'm a tiny little farmer. I farm for my family, and we sell the Asprey Farms meat in two small local community things to feed my neighbors, right? So, but I have practiced this on a tiny scale, but I've done it for 3 years with my family. I make my kids do the work, and I dream of scaling this up. And like, I got two guys on the show today who actually have scaled it up beyond one family farm in the U.S. So you're going to hear from Andy. Andy, say hi so people see what you look like on YouTube, or just hear from you if they're just listening.
Hey, guys.
All right. And Cody, say hi.
Hello.
All right, so now you know their voices. And this is cool because Andy actually looks as an overseer in multiple USDA-inspected processing plants, including the ones who service Grassroots, the major meat retailers and farmers, and the private label meat that you probably have eaten if you like to go spend more than $100 at a fine restaurant on, you know, world-class steak. So that's the processing side. And then Cody, how do you raise an animal that lives a good life? Eats clean food, is treated well from the time it's in its mother's womb, from the time it's weaned, if it even is weaned, and then until the time it makes its way to butchering and slaughtering. And yeah, you do slaughter animals before you eat them, because otherwise eating them before they're slaughtered is really rude, but you do it ethically and cleanly, and that is a part of the cycle of life. So guys, I'm honored to have you on Bulletproof Radio. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Cody, walk me through. Physicist, small farmer, here.
So I grew up in rural Arkansas, was the first person in my immediate family to go to college, went off, and I just happened to be good at math and ended up majoring in physics and math, but always wanted to move back to rural Arkansas where I grew up. And in the process of being in college and traveling a bit, I also fell in love with really good, high quality food being sourced from small scale farmers, food that you knew where it came from. You could get it fresh, and it was, that really made a big impact on me and when I was young. And so those two things kind of came together in, me moving back to Arkansas after I spent a few years teaching high school physics and math, and, met my now wife, and we were trying to find a way to create a living here in the rural Arkansas Ozarks. There's just not a lot of opportunities. And we thought we'd give livestock farming a shot. We were really inspired by folks like Joel Salatin and Michael Pollan in the beginning. And so in 2006, we kicked off our farm and we're looking at a pasture-based grass-fed livestock farm focused on regenerative agriculture, wanting to feed our community, create jobs, feed our family, and also, improve the land and the process. And so that was really, it's kind of a weird story, I guess. It's hard to connect the dots, but it's been a way for me to return to rural Arkansas and create a living and a life that's, we feel like we're having a big impact on our local community.
I get asked this every time I post a picture of my little baby sheep. Or I just posted a picture of a raw piece of bone-in ribeye, and It's got, you know, oregano on it, but it's still raw. I'm like, guys, I'm, you know, feeding my family with this. And I always get one or two very angry radical vegans. So how can you slaughter your family pets? And what? Okay, Cody, you had to go through this. You are a farmer. You have raised animals. You eat the animals themselves. How can you look an animal in the eye and then eat it?
Yeah, it's not always easy, for sure. And my wife was actually a vegetarian before, you know, at one point in her life. We actually have several employees on the grassroots staff who were either currently vegetarian or previously vegetarian.
I was a raw vegan. It made me sicker than hell. Like it really messed up my biology, and it has for tens of thousands of other people. So full disclosure for listeners, like it's okay if that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it's understandable that people, I mean, when all you see is the industrial meat system, it's understandable why folks would want to turn away from meat. But livestock animals have a really important role in our ecosystem. And livestock farming can do amazing things for the soil. I know we see so many stories about the challenges or the pollution that's caused by livestock production. But done in a small scale, appropriate scale, where you're rotationally managing the animals, you can actually improve the quality of the soil, create more diversity, and also, you know, more organic matter helps sequester carbon. Additionally, there's a lot of really important nutrients you get from eating grass-fed and pasture-raised livestock. And so I understand that we eat a lot of meat in this country. I actually am someone who thinks that we should eat a little less on average.
Amen.
But better quality. And that animals are really important to keeping really healthy ecosystems. And so it's done in balance. I think it can be, it's a fantastic thing, but it is, with life, there's death. And so there's always going to be some, whether you're, mowing a pasture and killing some insects, there's always going to be something dying. And so, in our case, we do harvest our animals, and it's a sad day when they leave, but it also is a day to celebrate. And we do everything we possibly can we prepare the meats to really, show, really respect the animal and make sure that we use the whole carcass. So.
I actually did some math. I met a Tibetan monk in Tibet, a lama who ran a monastery. I'm not an actual lama. Since we're a farming conversation today, no alpacas either.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, man, I've just been at your vegetarian retreat and you tell me no killing, but you got, isn't that a yak skin on your prayer pole? And you're a hypocrite. And they like robust debate. So he laughs at me. He goes, no, one death feeds everyone. I was like, mind blown. And you figure out your little like tofurkey thing, the number of bunnies, turtles, and you guys have lots of those big frogs down there in Arkansas. All right. And you run a tractor through your soybean crop. And if it wasn't so poisoned that all the animals were dead in the first place, you can pick up enough frog's legs to eat for a week behind a tractor, not to mention snake parts and turtles and bunnies and all that. Like it's nasty, right? And so you're saying, like, I have my cruelty-free tofu. No, you don't. Like, you just destroyed an ecosystem. But if you have a grass-fed cow, what else is going on in that pasture where the cow is? Assuming you're bringing a lot of grass in, if you're rotating, what else do you see on the ground around the cow?
Yeah, you see, earthworms. You see, all kinds of diversity in the grasses, legumes and different grasses developing. So it's when you manage it properly, you create more life and more diversity in a way that's really exciting and actually makes a small farm more productive and better for the environment. So
I heard that. Joel Salatin was on Bulletproof Radio probably 7-8 years ago. I've had some other regenerative agriculture people on over the time, Paul Stamets. But having really jumped in about 5 years ago, we moved to this property. We restored the former 5-acre gravel pit to productive soil. But watching where the pigs go, watching where the sheep go, and just the explosion of life that comes from that, I am more committed to taking care of this. 3 years ago, I was one of the people who supported the XPRIZE carbon capture thing. This is a thing where a group of people get together, donate money and expertise to figure out how to how to capture carbon. And all of the research for that was, oh, we have this amazing technology. It's like solar powered and everything. It's called soil, and it captures carbon better than almost anything. So we could like make solar cells, or we could just have some animals crap somewhere, and then we could capture enough carbon to save the world, right? Oh, yeah, and we're running out of topsoil in 60 years because of industrial farming. Do you have any metrics from Cody, from either your own farm or the network that you put together for grassroots, that shows how much soil you're building while you're providing, you know, basically mail order access to this kind of super high quality trackable food? How much soil have you added back to the world?
So one interesting metric, you know, we take soil tests about every year to see what our organic matter looks like and how it's improving or maybe not improving. And it's been amazing watching over the years our soil organic matter, which is basically like the fluffy brown part right there on top of the soil there, right under the grass. And the more you have of that, the more carbon that soil can sequester. And we've seen our soil, our organic matters go from 1.5%, 1.9% up to almost 4%. And so one way to look at this is every percentage point that you increase that organic matter on an acre of soil, you increase that soil's water holding capacity by 20,000 gallons. And so seeing, you know, we've increased about, you know, couple of percentage points on the acreage that we farm, it creates it really increases the soil's water holding capacity along with carbon sequestration. So we've seen the proof in those results. And you can also see it when you go out and you just look at the grasses compared to, you'd see bare spots before, and now you're seeing, you know, it's just completely covered. Our pastures green up sooner than our neighbors' pastures. They go longer into the winter. It's just, our cattle look healthier. It's just a different, there's all kinds of little proof points in what we're seeing on our farm every day.
So you're seeing it. You have more experience. You started in 2006. In my limited amount, once we put up some fencing to be able to move the sheep from one pasture to another, you're going, wait, they're in that pasture because the grass is 1.5 feet tall. And then the one where they weren't, even though I live in summer, it's like paradise up here.
Yep.
The grass is a different color, and it's just so painfully obvious. So I feel connected to the cycle of life. But you know, I used to live in Palo Alto. You know, I traveled to New York and you know, all over the place. And I know how lucky I am to do that. I also know how inconvenient it is. I also know that the land is dirt cheap when you live in the middle of nowhere like you do, and like I do too. So there are advantages, but for people who can't do that, I've been disturbed. And one of there were global shortages of grass-fed butter because of Bulletproof Coffee. And I've been saying, if you're not eating grass-fed, you're doing dairy wrong, you're doing meat wrong, and you're causing harm to the world. You're causing harm to yourself. And I believe that 100%. And I do not eat industrial animals. I will be a radical vegan before I'll do that, because it's bad for you. However, being a radical vegan is bad for you too. So like, damn if you do, damn if you don't, grass-fed is your answer. But so if you do it, but now you go out there and there's people saying, oh, it's grass fed. And then you find out, oh yeah, except for, you know, they fed it a bunch of whatever to fatten it up and give it diabetes in the last 90 days of its life. So that, like, grass finished is important.
Yeah, that's right.
But then you don't know if it was finished on GMO grass in a feedlot where they just shoveled grass in. What are your standards for that? And then I want to switch over to Andy and talk about, you know, okay, fine, it was fed right, but what's going on in industrial slaughter versus small farmer slaughter and where the problems are? But okay, first off, how do people know that they're getting something real?
So we've always had a deep commitment to being radically transparent with our customers. Like our standards that all of our farmers follow are published on our website. We know that every package of meat that a customer gets, they know exactly which farm it came from. We have a little QR code on there that they can trace. Actually on a blockchain powered platform, exactly like where it was raised, where it was processed, how it was raised. So the first thing is really trying to give customers as much information as possible so that they can make an educated decision on what they want and they can trust what they get. Additionally, you know, we want to bring, you know, we bring customers out to do tours on our farms, open farm policies. Right. And so there's a, a real commitment from day one on, you know, we connecting our farmers. I mean, I'm a farmer, the farmers that are part of Grassroots directly with customers, so that there's, you know, there's not this distance. And, you know, if you go and buy a steak in the grocery store, you have no, you know, almost, unless you're buying from a local co-op, you know, you can probably buy something that came from a local farmer. But yep. In most cases, like at your stores you're selling to. But in most cases, most national chains, there's no transparency or traceability at all. You have no clue even, you know, what country it came from in most cases. And so really trying to shorten that, that just make it basically where when a customer's buying, they're buying directly from the farm. That's what they're doing when they're buying from Grassroots. And so, you know, it's, and all of our, especially on the grass fed side, when it comes to our beef, all of our beef is 100% grass fed and grass finished. You know, they're being finished on, you know, out on pasture, on grass. You know, it's never, there's never any grain involved at all.
And how many different farms are a part of Grassroots right now?
So right now we're close to, we're 45 farms right now.
And so last time we talked, you were at like 27. So more and more are joining, but do they have to like sign off on your list of standards for feed and all that in order to join?
We actually have, so we have a great partnership with the, with a local nonprofit, Heifer International. They do work all around the world, but they have a domestic program called Heifer USA, and they work with us. They have a training farm, and we partner with them, and we send our farmers there to get training, to do classes, to learn more about how to meet our production standards. So it's sort of like a pipeline developed of new farmers or interested farmers.
So they train them. They certify them, and then you're like, okay, you can come in because you treat the animals well. You know, you allow them enough time with their mothers and all that kind of stuff.
That's right. And then we have people on Grassroots staff. So we're very different. You know, we're not just going out and finding someone who's already established. We're actually training new farmers, helping new farmers. Yeah. I mean, that's one of our core missions is to help create the next generation of farmers. And so we work closely with Heifer to do that. And that's a big part of our process. And that way, you know, we don't buy from a farm that we haven't set foot on. So it's, you know, we have people out working closely with them and developed a relationship, usually over a course of a couple of years before we actually start purchasing from them.
Thank you for doing that work. And it's really hard. And I was really blown away when we first started talking a couple of years ago. I actually started buying your stuff when I do 40 Years of Zen, the neurofeedback, you know, 5-day program where we're buying your bacon. It's really hard to get clean bacon. Yeah. I grow my own bacon. I just can't send it over the border.
Yeah.
So yours is the top, the highest quality I could get. What I like is you can literally take a picture of each thing on your phone. The QR code pops up everything you'd want to know about it. And what made me really impressed by that was my own experience. You know, having gone through and sort of like, all right, I'm just going to do a little bit. I don't have a dream of running a large scale grass fed farm. I have a dream of, you know, being at one with the world around me and letting my children and, you know, my family experience that. Nourishing my local community, maybe growing enough for my little restaurant here.
Yeah.
But I was most concerned about slaughter. So when you had two pigs, my wife's dad was going to come down, who's lived in a log cabin for 50 years, and he's like, "Yep, I know how to do that." Although he has more of a Canadian redneck accent, and also some Czech in there as well. But literally, we were going to, you know, butcher the pigs on property, and then, you know, put in the infrastructure necessary to really do the highest integrity. But then he couldn't make it over. And we're like, okay. So I went to the local meat processing house and, you know, Andy, we're getting into your part of the world. And I found, you know, there were two of them that were certified. Maybe there were three at the time on the island where I live. It's a large island, Vancouver Island. But now there's only two. It was a couple of years later, right? Only two small artisanal processors. And I'm worried about that because one of them, the guy's getting older and his kids don't want to run it. And I'm looking at these people saying, I want a sustainable job. You want a sustainable job? Man, start a small, certified, high integrity, high ethical meat processing plant and make some sausage and some bacon there, and you will be incredibly wealthy. You'll be nourishing your society. You will be providing an act of service, and you'll be able to look every animal in the eye and know that you're doing the right thing. And that is my standard, right? And if I'm not willing to do that, I'm not willing to eat it. And I know that you guys do that, Cody. But what I want to know is, how the heck did you find a meat processor who would have that level of standard and track it? Because even now, I'm like, I'm pretty darn sure that they gave me my pig back.
Yeah.
But one year, they didn't put the name of each pig on the package. And I was so traumatized because I wanted to see which of the two tasted different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I will say, you know, so for years, we actually processed all of our poultry on farm because we could not find a processor we felt good about. And I will say that was, you know, grassroots it's been a challenge. The infrastructure to support small family farms doing what we're doing just does not exist anymore. And so, you know, we almost went out of business because we could not find the right processor. We were using 6 different processors trying to find the right one. And then I met Andy, and you know, it was someone who cared so much about animal welfare, about the quality, about, you know, understood the importance. You know, been out numerous times on my farm, you know, understands what we're doing and the importance of it. And we decided, let's form a partnership together and launch a poultry processing business. And then we also partnered with him on his red meat plant too. And so, you know, it was tough. And I don't know if there are many folks out there like Andy. He's a pretty special person. And we were, it really gave grassroots a chance to succeed because of that partnership. And you can't have meat if you don't have a really high quality processor. And that's what we found in Andy, and we were fortunate to do it.
So Andy, tell me about Big Meat. You know, these big food processors, the big meat packing plants. We've been seeing all these things, both in the U.S. and in Canada, about, you know, meat shortages. If you can call it meat, I'm going to be straightforward. If you're still eating industrial meat, it's like saying there's a shortage of food because we don't have Snickers bars. That actually isn't food. what's going on? Why is it so concentrated, first of all? And then why are people getting so sick at those things? What's happening?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you look at what people have said in the past of being too big to fail, I think we're seeing quite the opposite now. I think they're just too big to stay continually in motion while all this is going on. When you've got that many employees concentrated in one location, it's almost impossible to keep everybody healthy and at work. And I think that we're seeing the repercussions of having a centralized food system right now.
One of the things that those the big food industrial processors are famous for is crowding not just chickens. And man, I went to college in the Central Valley in California, and I watched when Tyson bought up all the you know, turkey farmer contracts and all that, and they're smashing all these animals into things. It was horrible. Some of my friends, you know, were in that industry, and they were all kind of like, I can't believe this, but you know, we're going to go out of business if we don't, you know, give into that. But I look at what they're doing, but they also smash their workers in similar things. So sure, they're bringing people in from outside the U.S. quite often, which doesn't mean that those are people who are more or less likely to have a disease. But what it does mean is that if you have them living in a dormitory style thing without a lot of, you know, with shared bathrooms, you know, without a lot of space, and apparently this is happening a lot, just the working conditions where you're crowded and then you're living close together because you're rotating people in and out like that. Is that a part of the problem here where they're smashing the animals together, they're smashing the people together, like there's just enough space, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I think that's a large part of it. I think having that many people in a confined space is very hard to manage. I think, you know, as Cody has highlighted the problems of industrial ag from a farming standpoint, there's the same problems that are happening in processing as well. And I think anytime that you try to get that many people in, not only is the numbers against you and the volume of people that you're putting in a facility, but it's also hard to just even the policies and procedures that are in place. You know, it's just hard to get everybody to follow those. When you're going in and you're having sending out blanket emails or you're putting up a poster by the time clock, that's different than going and having one-on-one conversations with people that you care very deeply about and people that that you know by first name, you know their wife's name, in most cases know their children, and you can come to them and say, look, we've got a mission here. We've got farmers that's coming to us that need to get their product to market. And in most cases, you know, our workers know these farmers or a lot of these farmers. And so they're committed to these people to get their product out. And they're committed to know that they're feeding local communities and rural in their own communities. And so they have a sense of ownership. If they want to be there, they take pride in that and take pride in keeping themselves healthy.
This idea of decentralized food production is very scary to large corporate interests. the idea that, oh, people within 100 miles of where anyone listening to this lives might be growing animals in a way that protects soil. It's very hard to scale that up and roll it together and centralize it and grind down wages and all that stuff. And that the animals might be of different quality. And then instead of trucking them all over the place to a central authority where essentially all the animals get treated exactly the same, whether they're higher quality, lower quality, you mix it all together. You know, images of that Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall commercial, you know, everyone's marching into the little meat thing. It's kind of like that. That is the exact opposite of what we're doing, where you pair a family farm with a butcher, a slaughterhouse, but where, okay, you don't let the animals see each other get slaughtered, right? And you allow the animals time to calm down after just the trauma of a truck ride, okay? And not a crowded together truck ride across state lines where some of them freeze to death, which is not uncommon with industrial meat processing, but a ride down the road, oftentimes towed by a pickup truck. When you have something like that, it's what comes out the end of that process is a very different thing. And it's because the farmer cared, because he knows he's going to eat it, and he knows that his family and his community is going to eat it. And the person who does the work knows that as well. What's different in, I mean, do you pay more than a normal slaughterhouse to your people? Is there different training? Like, how do they know to do this ethically? You know, do they have to meditate before they, I know you're in Arkansas, they might not meditate, but like, what's different?
We don't have required meditating yet. We don't, that's not requirement yet, although they can if they would like. You know, I think what we try to do is we do want to pay a living wage for sure, but it's more than that. It's we want to teach a skill set. They're, when they come in, it's not that they're going to do cut this wing off this chicken for the next 20 years, or they're going to grind hamburger at this station for the next 10 years. We're going to come in and we're going to teach them about the industry. We're going to teach them how to bring this animal in, all the way from when they're harvesting the animal, all the way through the process of fabricating it, cutting it into retail cuts for the consumer, packaging it, boxing it, learning the USDA regulations and guidelines. What we're doing is we're not just trying to set a factory line a position. We're trying to teach them a skill set that's very valuable. And we want to give them an opportunity to grow. We want to invest in their lives. And we want to see them succeed. You know, it's from the farmer side all the way through the processing side. We want total integrity throughout the value chain.
This is one of those things where, okay, sometimes if you want it done right, you at least have to learn it yourself, even if you don't have to do it yourself. So when I started doing this, I went out to one of the local slaughterhouses and I said, all right, guys, I need you to teach me how you do what you're doing. And I spent a whole day there. And I wish I had some good video of this. This was a few years ago.
Love to see that.
But I went out there. All right. This was before we even got our animals. I said, all right, you know, I actually want to be able to show me how do you harvest a sheep. Right. You know, if I'm willing to do this, you know, let's do it. I'm buying sheep from a neighbor, but they're already, you know, pre-cut up. And then they said, all right, here's how we do it. Here's how we skin it. Here's how you take it down to a bandsaw. And I can tell you, it is damned hard to cut up an animal in a good way. Right. And when I say cut up an animal in a good way, okay, it had to be butchered ethically. Both of you can tell me what happens if you basically, I think you use the word harvest, basically if you kill an animal that is in terror, what happens to the meat?
Well, if it's stressed, it's certainly going to be, you're going to have color variations and it's not going to be nearly as tender.
It gets tough and it tastes bad, right? So that said, I've seen videos in industrial slaughterhouses at scale. They have machines that do this and they do not care if an animal is scared, right? That there is no compassion. There's nothing good there that I can possibly say. And facing that, I'm not eating that, right? It's unethical to do it, right? On every level, from an animal level, from an environmental level. And the mission that I'm working on right now is, look, because that's evil, going to the exact opposite is I'm never eating animals again. You will get sick. Your children will be less healthy. The number of people who are less fertile will go down over time, and we will slowly grind away the soil on our planet, and we will not like what happens. The only thing left is for there to be more people like you, Cody, and more farms like yours. And at the same time, farmers like you, like me, like your network, I will not send my animals to an industrial slaughterhouse. I do not want to do that. I will not send them 100 miles away from my house because I care about my animals. It's not okay, right? So you have to have decentralized slaughterhouses, right? So Andy, what do you say to the regulatory people say, well, that might not be safe, right? So just, you know, now's your chance to say what you really think about that.
Well,
don't worry, they're not listening.
There's a lot of yeah, that's right. I'll cross my fingers. I'll pay for this on Monday morning. I think that, you know, it starts out with, you know, you talked about how the meat is treated and the quality, you know, on the processing side, but also the quality that it comes in. That also goes to food safety. You know, when grassroots brings product in, they're bringing in extremely high quality product. They're also bringing in a very safe product. You know, we're not getting in animals that are covered in feces or have been sitting knee deep in mud for extended periods of time. Like, these animals are coming in clean. We've got lower bacteria counts on these animals as they come in, so it makes our job a whole lot easier. With that being said, you know, we've got a lot more time on the processing floor and the harvest floor to be able to address that. We've got interventions in place that are, you know, all natural interventions that are in place to address that. But we're having to address a lot lower microbial load on those animals because of the grower standards and practices of grassroots and farmers like that. And so I think that when you look at the volume that goes through our facilities, when you're looking at less than 100 animals, you know, 100 beef a week or 100 hogs a week, we've got less than, 20 to 25 people in the large animal plants. You look at that and you put those in the facility, and it sets us up to succeed in a way that's really difficult when you're in contrast to a large facility doing beef, where you're looking at over 5,000 head a day, or you're looking at hogs over 20,000 a day. I mean, where it's totally different line speeds. There's an investment from our team and our employees that can be there that just can't be found in a plant going that fast.
So one option is we just make all the workers of those plants wear astronaut suits in case they might come in contact with each other's cooties or any of the antibiotic resistant bacteria that are coating all of the food. I mean, it's not food, but the animals that they bring in because of the rampant antibiotic use and the fact that they're feeding them corn and soy and grains that are not useful. And so that is one path. Right. And if you do that, I don't know which you guys would have the better thing. What's the average price in the U.S. for a pound of ground crap beef?
Well, on today's market.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
It's over $4 a pound right now on the current commodity market.
So at a grocery store, are people going to spend about $4 a pound, or are they going to spend $5 a pound because of styrofoam plates and all that?
I would say $4 to $5 right now. Yeah.
Okay. And that's so you're listening to the show.
That's a real high right now, given the shortage. Right.
Well, there's 40% of our meat capacity just got taken offline because people are getting sick. Sure.
That's right.
And that does say that the people who are working in industrial slaughterhouses are generally unhealthy, right? And that could be because they're paid below a poverty wage, and poverty is associated with not being healthy. There's that. They're overcrowded, and they're constantly exposed to animals covered in unhealthy bacteria because of what they ate and all the antibiotics they had. So, like, that is a job that is a rough job, and it's rough, you know, long shifts, crowded sleeping quarters. Like, it is just a recipe for humans to get sick as well as for animals to get sick. So we lost 40% of our capacity, so the price of meat's gone up. Before the pandemic, we were at about $3 a pound?
Probably, less. $3 at retail. Probably.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. So we got a 25% increase. All right, Cody, grassroots co-op. I want to get some ground beef, a pound of ground, sent to my door, grass-fed, raised by a farmer who knew the animal's name and worked with the animal, and an ethical butcher processed by Andy.
Yeah.
You can look at the entire chain, and you know it's got the right fats and has no antibiotics and, like, all of those things.
Yeah.
How much does that cost?
About 10 bucks a pound.
So wait a minute. You're saying I'm going to go from $4 a pound to maybe $4.50?
Yep.
To $10. So that's roughly twice as expensive to eat ethically raised grass-fed beef that supported a living wage for a group of people, soil.
Yep.
It seems like you're underpriced. I say that.
Yeah.
Okay, Superhuman just came out. It's my anti-aging book.
Yeah.
Everyone's eating too much protein. You don't want too much protein. You don't need as much meat. So here's the deal. If you're listening to the show, I've been saying this for more than 10 years. It's in all of my books. People have lost 1 million pounds or more on the Bulletproof diet. I'm not kidding. Eat half as much meat and pay twice as much for it. And if you do that, you will save your own biology. You will live longer. You probably won't get cancer. Your skin will look better. You'll be happier. And you'll support your entire community. You'll support ethical treatment of animals. You'll support soil. You'll support jobs. And if you instead say, oh, I'm going to save money. And I know money's tight. And the bottom line is, seriously, replace the other half of the meat with other things that are cheaper than meat. And there's lots of them. If you do that, you will immediately receive your personal health dividend from that. But your long-term, I'm going to call it the karmic impact of what you're doing, you will cause less suffering in the world than eating a fake meat substitute product. And I mean this from jobs, from other life forms like cute bunnies and turtles and all that kind of stuff. Like, there is zero downside. And the fact you're eating less meat because it's more expensive will only make you live longer. But if you go down to zero meat, bad news. It's a U-shaped curve. You're going to fail on either end. And so that's it. It's twice as expensive and it's worth it. You can spend more at a local, you know, artisanal butcher. And you might want to do that too, which isn't, you know, what Cody does. Cody, you know, he'll ship you from Grassroots Co-op. He'll ship you the meat and is world-class. And right now you probably have to cook at home anyway. But hey, support your local butcher, right? If you have a local butcher you're lucky.
All for that.
Keep that guy in business.
Yeah, we're definitely all for that. And we're definitely, you know, all for, you know, eating better quality and less meat too. That's definitely a position we have. And I think that, you know, people's health will benefit from it. And so will the environment, and local rural communities, especially.
So, your budget should be the same for meat as it was before, but you will change how you feel. What's best, for small farmers? There's poultry, right? Which is, you know, one side of it, they grow very rapidly and they, okay, I'm just being real straightforward. They shit everywhere. Birds are nasty. Okay.
Fertilized.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I don't like chickens. I like turkeys. They're better. Okay. And then, of course, there's pigs. And pigs are actually very interesting animals. And they're actually low maintenance. And I really enjoy pigs. And properly fed pigs are very healthy. And improperly fed pigs are very dangerous. So if you're listening to the show, industrial pork is the number one meat to avoid. Because pigs have the same weaknesses humans have, and that they use their kidneys instead of their liver to process toxins. So they build up nasty stuff in their fat. So if you were to splurge on one organic grass-fed properly done thing, I would tell you, if you're going to eat pork, eat grassroots pork, like do that instead of eating crap bacon somewhere, because your health impact will be even higher there. But I'm asking you, you got chickens, you got pork, you got grass-fed beef. I don't think you guys do lamb, right?
We do a little lamb, some lamb.
A little bit of lamb. Yeah, okay, good deal.
Yeah,
all right. So from a farming perspective, what do farmers like better? I only have experience in a couple of those.
Yeah, so I think it depends on what their land is like. You know, we encourage diversity. So there's actually a nice symbiotic relationship between birds, whether it's chickens or turkeys, and herbivores, you know, sheep, lamb, or goats or beef. And so like on our farm, we have every species. We have chickens right now on the pasture, turkeys on the pasture, pigs in the forest, cattle out on the pasture grazing. And so you, you know, but some farms, if they're smaller farms, they don't have enough acreage for beef, for instance. It sounds like your farm, it's a little bit smaller, lamb work out better or something like that. Yeah.
I could have like two cows. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And so it depends on your land base. Some farms, we're actually starting to work with a cooperative of farmers in Mississippi right now. They're in sort of the training phase, and they have land that's well suited for pork production. They have these great pine and oak forests that are going to be perfect for raising forest-raised pork. And they don't have a great, you know, it's not ideal for raising chickens. It gets too, it's just not, the topography is not right. And so really it just depends on the topography, the land base, and ideally you're finding ways to have multiple species so that you can really benefit from the symbiotic relationships. It makes the farm more efficient, also makes the, improves, you know, you're able to do more soil building when you have that diverse mix of species rotating across. And so really you're just trying to make it as the most natural environment possible. So for us, our pigs are mostly in the forest on our farm. They do a bit in the pasture, but they roam through the forest where they get acorns and hickory nuts and, different berries there at certain times of the year. They get pawpaws that fall off the trees in the fall. And then when they rotate through our forest, they're opening up that forest and you get grass growing underneath. And so it's a great way to utilize a part of our farm in a way that is really creating a more, is a better quality, healthier animal. The pork chops are amazing. And then also improving the biodiversity in the soil at the same time.
When we moved to our place, the land had been abused. There was a gravel pit on the front that's now, a gentle sloping grassland after a lot of tractor work and topsoil building. But the forests are also just all overgrown and crappy. I did not understand how expensive it is to have humans go through with chippers and stuff and clean up a forest. Yeah. Or you could just fence it off with temporary electric fencing and throw pigs in there.
That's right.
And they turn into a park.
Yeah.
It is ridiculous how healthy a forest is when it has animals return to it other than just deer.
Yep, I totally agree.
And I think most people are... You would have no way of knowing this unless you heard it on the show, because why would you care? But the idea of forest raised pigs, well, hold on, you're helping the forest, the grass is in the forest. It's magical what happens there.
Is, yeah.
And the side effect is happy pigs and at the end of the day, meat. Now, what are these small farmers, the ones you work with in your network, how worried are they about the coronavirus? How affected are they by it?
Well, I think the concern is, like just what they see in the news around supply chain shutting down. And so I think we have, working with Andy, and as he's highlighted already, the crews that just the buy-in he has from his employees. When you're a smaller plant like that, you're able to be much more nimble. You don't have the bureaucracy of having to get 6,000 employees up to speed on something. We're talking about 20 or 25 employees. And so I think there are concerns around that. We're taking extra caution on the farms around biosecurity, just making sure that when people come on, they wear a mask or have booties on. And so just really trying to be careful. But for most farms, it really hasn't. We're usually practicing social distancing anyway. We live out in the middle of nowhere. Not a lot has changed, except that Grassroots is seeing an increase in sales. And so we're, able to give these farms more business and bring on new farms. So that's really right now. The biggest change for us has just been overwhelming customer interest at this moment. People being at home, wanting to cook more, caring more about, health is really taking it's clear people just are being more health conscious at this time and taking this seriously.
So the farmers, kind of like where I am, I don't see a lot of people other than a few local community people, because I live on a farm, right?
Yeah,
It's not like you're in a metropolis, right?
Yeah.
So I haven't noticed the things. So I wear the mask when I go to the hardware store every now and then, mostly because it looks goofy. But even then, social distancing would be very easy. So they're all experiencing that, but I guess they're experiencing this increase in demand. And I guess I saw that as well. We're almost sold out of our pork for the first time, just because people are like, oh, you have pork? We want pork.
Yeah.
The underground pork economy here. So increase in demand. Why do you think that's happening now? Is coronavirus, is it just because more people are home cooking? So everyone's going to Grassroots and saying, look, if I'm going to cook, I would like to be healthy right now. It's a good time to do it. Or is it is it more of like an environmental awareness? Like, you know, maybe it's time to take care of the world and myself. What do you think it is?
Yeah, I think it's probably, it's a mix of all those things. I do think a big chunk of it is people just, they're cooking more, which is super exciting. I mean, that's, you know, it's amazing how much better the world would be if we were all cooking a lot more at home. You know, I mean, I'm all for restaurants, but just like cooking at home versus going to Wendy's, you know, that's a good thing for the world. And people, you know, at home, they're splurging a bit more, you know, and they're focus more on health. We're definitely seeing that. We're selling more, you know, chicken backs for stock right now. People are really, you know, we're seeing more
bone broth.
Yeah, bone broth is really, really something that people are craving right now. And for good reason, you know, there's a lot of nutrients packed in there. And so,
You know what drives me nuts? One of the large powdered bone broth protein brands, I'm not going to call them out. You know, Bulletproof makes collagen, but we don't do a bone broth thing like that. Like a bone broth protein. Dude, it's from industrial raised chickens. Industrial raised chickens. Like, you don't want to eat those bones. They're full of toxic metals and they're full of antibiotic residues.
Yeah.
Like, man, I wouldn't throw one of those in a stock pot. I would, frankly, this is some really egregious, but I wouldn't feed those to my pigs because it would make my pigs sick. And like, I don't want to make my pigs sick and I don't want to make the people eat my pigs sick. Right. And now if I was starving, that would be a different animal. Yeah. Right. But I'm not starving. Right. So I'm looking at that, like this is part of my food chain, part of what my kids eat. And so I don't, you know, you can make an industrial waste process thing into that, but I'm not alone because people are saying I'm going to order chicken back. So I'll make my own broth, which is, you know, kudos to you if you're doing that. And by the way, if you're listening to this and you do that, you're saving a ton of money over food delivery. Yeah. And by the way, please do some food delivery too. So the restaurants will still be there after the pandemic. Absolutely. And if you order from the Bulletproof Grass-Fed Cafe in LA on delivery, thank you for that as well. By the way, 6 years of running a restaurant that has never served anything but grass-fed 100% of the time, because I believe in this. But anyway, I'm rambling a little bit there, but just your belief on their motivation is some health, some extra cooking, some environmental, but you don't have a dominant answer.
Yeah, we don't have. I think it's a bit of both, and I think that we're definitely seeing though an incredible uptick. I also think people, you know, it's convenient too. I mean, it's a safe way. You know, you can order online and ship straight to your door. I also think that other places are experiencing outages in a way that. You know, it's, I do think there is a growing awareness of the vulnerability of our meat supply chain, especially at the processing level. When one company or one plant produces, you know, 130 million servings every week, you know, and is producing 5% of the country's pork, that is a scary position to be in. And I think people are really waking up to that right now. So,
I was just one interesting thing too, is Cody mentioned, you know, is there's a lack of supply on the grocery shelves, and some of these people are defaulting to this product and trying it out for the first time. Maybe they wouldn't have otherwise. And I think when they get it, kind of goes back to what you talked about earlier, is the difference in the quality of this product. And when they get that in and they try it for the first time, and maybe they would have never done it otherwise, I think it's going to be interesting to see how many people notice that, realize what a difference there is and stay with it.
You know, thank you for saying that. There's something, something I learned going from weighing 300 pounds and just on the journey of Bulletproof. And my big diet book came out in 2014 explaining this grass-fed thing and helping to people understand how big it was. I call it a food high, but we're used to food high. Like I had, you know, pizza and beer and I'm, you know, kind of lit up. But that's like a jangly feeling. When you eat a pastured pork belly, right, that's cooked right, not like deep fried and burned in too much, or you eat a grass-fed ribeye where the fat's yellow because it ate so much grass. About like 20 minutes after you eat that, I don't know the right word for it, but there's this feeling I feel like in my chest. It's like you're just like bursting with this like good energy, not like coffee, not like sugar. It's a different thing. Your body's like, yes, like that's what I needed. And I tell you, if you're listening to this and you've never had good quality grass-fed, grass-finished meat, you cook it right. Don't burn the crap out of the outside of it. Don't put, you know, cheap barbecue sauce and ketchup all over it. You know, just treat it with respect in your kitchen. Be careful. You're going to have a different night, like after you eat that dinner. You will have different dreams. I'm not even kidding. Like that is the difference in what this food does for you. And so like to your point there, Andy, people will try it and they're going to get that food high. And in my goal, and I think we hit it most of the time in my little Bulletproof Cafe place down in Santa Monica. It's like every time someone comes in, I want to give them that thing. And man, we work hard on it. I don't know that everyone feels it every time, but you know, the quality matters and it gets integrated into the way you show up that day and the next day. And I got a question for you though, Andy. Just help me understand in comparison is you got Cypress Valley Meat Company. How many employees do you have compared to like a big old meat packing industrial facility? Like what's the percentage there?
Well, across all our locations that we have, including poultry, we're under 100 people at all locations. And so when you look at one location having several thousand, I mean, that really puts it in perspective. And, you know, when we're the largest facility that we have is on the poultry processing side in terms of employees. And there's 55 there that work over two shifts. And so it's just a huge contrast to what you see in industrial processors.
Industrial processors look like factories. I mean, there's giant parking lots and shuttles and, you know, people coming in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's what they are. You're right.
I mean, 6,000 people in some of the beef plants that have shut down. You know, it's a small city, small town.
All right, let's talk tech. Yeah, I'm a Silicon Valley guy, and I remember reading the very first white paper the year it came out around Bitcoin. And in another life, I used to teach early classes on encryption for the first wave of e-commerce at the University of California. So I read it, and I'm like, oh my God. Like, this guy's a genius. I understand. I see how it all works. And then I thought to myself, you know what? It'd be really cool to set up a laptop to do some Bitcoin mining. But seriously, I'm starting this, you know, Bulletproof thing and I've got two young kids, whatever. I only had one young kid at the time. And so I'm like, you know, this is cool, but it's one thing I'm just going to choose not to do. I still regret that decision. But here we are, not that many years later, and you are actually using the blockchain, which is not Bitcoin. It's the distributed ledger part of it. But in meat processing, which I would have thought if you told me that 5 years ago that you were just stupid and you were following some industry trend, even though I know how it all works, but I'm like, is there really a demand for this? But I was wrong. So tell me why you chose to use blockchain in food production and why people actually care.
Yeah. So, you know, this really goes back to what I was talking about earlier around our commitment to transparency. And that's what this was kind of born out of, was a desire to be as radically transparent as we possibly could. And in our search, you know, sort of our passion for that and our sort of journey to be as transparent as possible, you know, we came across a company based out of the UK called Provenance, and they had developed a blockchain powered platform that was developed for supply chains to help create more transparency across that supply chain so that you could trace the journey of a product all the way from start to finish. And in our case, all the way from the farm to the processor to the customer's plate. And so, you know, that's what really drew us was that commitment. You know, when I first stumbled into this, I'd heard of blockchain or heard of Bitcoin, but didn't really have any clue, like, you know, hadn't really learned much about blockchain. But when I was able to sort of started, you know, digging into this and read more about Provenance's platform, it really, you know, just, it was clear that a distributed ledger like this that can be, you know, where you can take information and records and store them in a publicly displayed way that's also secure and can't be corrupted or, you know, if someone can't go in and change the data, really stuck with me and was something that resonated, and we wanted to implement that. And so we were the first meat supply chain in the country to really roll this out all the way to where when a customer gets a package of Grassroots, you know, a ribeye or a package of ground beef, they can scan that package, the QR code, and they can trace the journey all the way from farm to fork, knowing, you know, learning about how it was raised, but also like where it went each stage, and be able to and do that all on a blockchain powered platform.
How do you know that someone doesn't just put the QR code tied to the blockchain on the sticker and then just put some crap meat in the package?
Well, you know, that's a Yeah. So I think part of this is having a, you build a sort of a network of trust here where you've got, you know, farmers. So when a farmer takes the chickens, they log in the information and they drop it off at the processor, and the processor uploads that information and confirms the receipt. So you get this sort of, this consensus based, a chain that's that, where over, time you're able to, all the, it takes all this information, presents it to the public where anybody can see it in a way that really discourages any sort of, misbehavior or fraudulent activity on this front. And so it's not a, it's not a silver bullet, but it is a great way to create a, if you could go in and trace and say every piece of chicken or beef you got in the grocery store or every apple, trace that, that would make, you give consumers a lot more information as to where their food's coming from.
It does. And it sounds like the real answer is, an unscrupulous processor could do that. But then let's see, they put cheap meat into an expensive meat package, but they can't take the expensive meat that they would have stolen and do anything with it except eat it. Because if they sell it as expensive meat, they have no provenance for it. So then they would have to sell the expensive meat as cheap meat. So it is self-limiting that way. And part of it, though, is that it would probably be cheaper for an unethical producer to just say, oh, yeah, and just randomly throw crap meat into the good packaging. But that's why you would never go to an industrial scale producer. And that's why I wanted to have Andy on the show here. Because look, we have a tight partnership, and Andy went to the trouble because he cares about, okay, this animal comes in. That means it has to be tracked throughout the slaughterhouse. How much more time does it take to do that versus just, a parts apart? Is that like a...
Yeah. Well, so I think one thing that's really interesting and or different about us is that, when you go into a larger processing plant, they have, say, chickens, for instance, they have chickens coming in from all different farms on one given day, and they just mix all that together. When we do, ours are actually batched individually by farm. And so, there's a lot. Andy can speak to the extra work, but we've always kept that, the individual farm, the day it was processed, that's all one separate lot that gives a radical level of traceability because of that. Otherwise, you would, when you go in and get a pound of ground beef, I've read that it could be 1,000 different animals in that one. We do single animal origin grind, where you can trace the exact, exactly which farm produced that, what day it went in and where it was processed. And so.
I remember when I was a kid, the idea of eating hamburger, anything more than medium rare, was kind of horrifying. Like, oh, that's burned. It's all gray in the middle. Why would you do that? And then at some point in my late teens, why would you eat a hamburger that wasn't gray throughout? Because it's probably going to get you really sick because we basically poisoned our food chain. I have returned to eating meat medium rare because all of my beef comes from the same animal. I know because I just buy half the cow, or it comes from the lamb. And I raised it when I held it when it was this big, right? So it's clean meat. And I know that it's butchered well because I've been there, and I would do the same thing. And I'm sure that your FDA standards say all meat must be cooked 156 degrees, whatever. I don't have to say that, but you might have to say it on the label. So I'd say I feel safe when I'm in the States. I order grassroots when I'm staying somewhere for a while, and I cook it. And I cook it medium rare or even rare. And it's a different thing. But you can only do it when it's single animal, not when it's that high-pressure industrial beef wash that they do now. It's frankly horrifying. What about things like broth, Andy? I mean, it would be really easy to take the bones, the beef bones, and make a value-added process product like grass-fed broth and all that. Is it something you've talked about doing, or Cody? Is that like a next step? Who does that? What do you do with the bones?
I think right now, well, a lot of times we're taking and selling the bones and letting the customers make the broth. But in the future, that we want to add those type of value-added products to what we do in our processing schedule.
I'm interested in that because I want to make it so that people who decide they want to run a business like yours, you know, it is meaningful investment, but you got to make enough returns that okay, you know, it's sustainable. So your kids want to do it or your investors want to do it. So that it's an attractive business because it's almost like, why do we pay our teachers nothing? And why do we pay like the really important parts of our food chain so low? It's backwards. But it feels to me like broth and bacon and sausage are really like the ways where people are willing to pay more for it. Demand for sausage that I'm seeing, my market size is like zero, but we sell out of sausage really fast here, and people want to pay more for it. And you know, we grow all of our own spices here anyway, so it's like, okay, next year I'm putting pretty much everything that's not a premium cut into sausage because it tastes good and it actually makes a little bit more, and I can use that to help pay the people on the farm who help out on the farm, and it works out. So it feels to me like you guys ought to, you know, Cody, work with your farmers, work with your processor, like get us some broth, get us some good sausage, get us some good bacon, you know.
And that's actually that the next step. So Andy's right on the cusp of doing an expansion to add some of these things in.
You
so,
are?
Yeah. So I'm send some of those investors Andy's way.
Do you have a URL? You know, if people are like, yes, I want to know to do it.
You can look. Yeah, you can look at CypressValleyMeatCompany.com or Natural State Processing. They both have websites for both the large animal processor and the poultry processor.
Okay, got it. And so that's in both in Arkansas. So if you guys want to find that, you're interested in it. It sounds like you're willing and able to talk to people. And I want to see, you know, a small number of meat processors, not more than the Markle Sport, spread out across the country. It's as important as having grass-fed is locally processed grass-fed meat. And that's how you break the big food meat monopoly. And that's the stuff that's driving animal cruelty and driving habitat destruction and driving, you know, animal shit in water and all that kind of stuff. And you guys are fighting the good fight against that. And the only way we will survive our 60-year horizon for having soil on the planet is more of what you're doing. Like that's why this matters. And so thanks for the work you're doing, guys. I'm all in on it. And now that I have an amateur level of experience that you guys have scaled up, I know how hard it is, but I know how rewarding and important it is. And just, you know, what a sacred act it is to, you know, take a life like that and make it part of the ecosystem and all that. And to be respectful throughout the entire life cycle, including to when you ship it to someone's house and it becomes a part of, you know, part of their life. So I am, you know, just truly, I'm grateful, but also just in a little bit in awe of the level of planning and detail and execution that you guys have done at scale. Cause I struggle with it for like, you know, a few sheep thank you, man, to be able to like live in a big city and order that. It's something very special and something very new in the world. And if we were to lose our local processors, we lose our local farmers, that's not the kind of world I want to live in. So I want you guys to keep doing what you're doing and do it even bigger.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
On that note, Grassroots Co-op, you're listening to the show. You've probably been listening for years, or maybe you're a brand new listener. I'm going to tell you what I think right now. And I'm going to tell you two things. One, if you're not eating local grass fed from a local farmer across the street or at your local farmer's market, then you need to go to Grassroots Co-op and you need to try it once. And don't burn the crap out of it. You know, don't put all some sort of weird bottled, you know, spice mix, whatever on it. Like do some real herbs and some quality salt and all that. Cook it to the best of your ability and just look at how you feel. Two times, a half hour after you eat and then the next morning when you wake up. You look at yourself in the mirror. You look at your muffin top and go, wait, I don't have the muffin top I would expect. I don't have the heavy feeling. I don't have the sore joints. That's what happens when you eat food that's good for you. Expect that food high. So do that. And it's also going to taste better. And because it's grass-fed and pastured, you cook a little bit less. It's a different product. So you go a little bit light on that because it has a different composition. So that's your challenge. For this week is eat something that is grass-fed and really good. And if you're a vegan, guys, I was a raw vegan. I can, you know, mash up an avocado like no one's business. I was a very, very good vegan cook. It gave me autoimmunity. I did lose weight. It made my teeth fracture. It gave me a thyroid condition. I got oxalic acid poisoning. I got more sensitive to lectins than I was before. It disrupted my gut bacteria. 100% plant-based diet is as stupid as 100% industrial diet. Neither one is functional for you. So just go out there and try what I'm saying. One meal and watch what happens. And then look at your, if you're one of the ethical vegans out there, you look at what we just talked about on the show. You look at the package. Go visit Andy. Go visit Cody. Heck, if you're on Vancouver Island, I'm probably not around for a farm tour. But I will tell you straight up, you visit that local farmer and you look at it and you realize that if you look at the number of deaths per thing, there was no ethical argument for you to be 100% vegan. There is a great ethical argument for you to save the planet by building soil, and you have to build animals into the world. So from that note, grassfedcoop.com, it matters on like every level aligns. It's physical, spiritual, environmental, all of it. And these guys have done it right. And if you don't believe them, you can actually like look at the provenance of where it came from. And I don't know a way to do this any better. And if I ever do, I'll tell you that. But right now, this is the best. And on that note, thank you for listening. Thank you for learning. Stay safe during the pandemic and eat some really good food you cook yourself, because now's a good chance to do it.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.